on a very gut level and a heart level that we can all understand, there's a tremendous stigma and there's a tremendous hatred and hypocrisy towards people in the sex trade. On a more complicated level, it's tied in very much to the laws that exist. It's tied into the laws around poverty. It's tied into laws around colonialism. Sex work laws historically have been used more than anything to control women, mostly working class women, who escaped from sort of patriarchal norms of what a good woman was.
Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy. A four-week special presentation of CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project. Every Wednesday for the next 4 weeks from 5 to 6 p.m. here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Feminists, abolitionists call for decriminalization of the industry all the time. What are they saying? They're saying that all women are exploited. They're looking at women who are working saying, you have not chosen to work. You are exploited. They're on a crusade to save women, but they're totally implementing a patriarchal structure of how they're going to do it, and it's ridiculous and absolutely ironic, and they don't realize
that we can play a role in transforming the conditions, that we have a part to play, just like marriage was transformed, just like civic rights were transformed for women. Well, so sex work can be transformed as well, and that we can remain sex workers.
Violence, we can choose that we will not have it anymore, that we will eliminate it because we will eliminate criminalization, we will eliminate the attitudes and the hatred. We will take this violence seriously.
So we are fighting right now to define sexual services as work.
Welcome to Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy. This is episode 3 of a 4-week special presentation of CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project. My name is Brett Story, and today we will be exploring the ways in which gender and sexuality inform the sex trade as experienced by those active in it. Sex work has been embraced within much feminist analysis and popular perception alike as an issue inextractable from female sexuality and the heterosexual dynamics between men and women. The lived and diverse experiences of sex workers who self-identify across a wide range of genders and sexualities, however, speaks to the great complexity to which gender and sexuality actually do inform the sex trade. Today we will be speaking to Miro Soleil Ross, a very interesting and outspoken transsexual street sex worker, activist, video maker, and performance artist. She spoke to me by telephone about feminism, the transsexual transgender movement, performance and activism, and her own experience with the sex trade. First, however, here is a sample of the myriad of ways people involved in the sex trade have come to understand gender and sexuality in relation to their work with the sex industry.
I think that a lot of people working in the sex workers' rights movement consider themselves feminists, and I think that's something that came out a lot in the discussions. The kinds of things that we're asking for are the same kinds of things women have been asking for historically in the movement. But there is a tendency for some lines of thinking, abolitionist feminists, to think that one cannot ask for those things as a sex worker, that sex work is the essence of violence against women. It's the essence of patriarchy. It's at the heart of powerlessness or victimization, and that one can't struggle against those things as a sex worker.
Like, as a gay person, I came out of the closet once. I know what it is. In some way, it's difficult. It's never easy to begin with, telling people you know. But eventually, as more people come out, the whole issue, the whole profession comes more public, and it gets to be more known. It's not something that's in the closet that belongs to the underworld.
Transsexual, transgender, come at Stella. But they always had to be dressed as women. And during the summer, I was there. As long as the person is identified as female and sex worker, they don't have to come in and be dressed as a female. It's 30 degrees out there. You do not have to come in with your wig and the whole regalia to show that you're a woman. As soon as we know they work as a woman, female.
Christopher Lee is a female-to-male transgendered person. He worked as a stripper for several years prior to transitioning, and then as he transitioned, became knocked out of the sex industry. So got together with other trans men who were sex workers in the past as women to try and create a new market for trans men and their lovers.
I did three works in a series. The first one was a 26-minute documentary on trans men, trans fags, and the whole spectrum of like masculine gender forms. And then after that, I got together with some people and I did an adult film called Alley of the Tranny Boys, and it was a kind of a 70s style, sort of gay male aesthetic looking film with some comedy and some drama and plenty of sex.
Since we live in a sexist society, I'm sure that women are much more not just oppressed but also discriminated against by clients. Because it's same-sex trade, often many clients will like the way I look, be attracted to me, but at the same time would like to be like me or like to be me. This will probably never happen with a man who acts as a woman.
That sexuality isn't this one uniquely lived thing which happens in an ideal bubble, diverse or not, that only involves loving and absolutely mutual and tender relationships with one another. It can happen in a variety of ways. I guess I take issue with this idea that sex of a particular kind, you know, like, is so intimate to a woman's identity that she can't just, you know, sell a service for a night without losing something that she can never regain. And we don't have the same knee-jerk attitudes about men who are working. We don't have that same, as far as I know from what I've heard, that same protectiveness over male sexuality. If men want to have a one-night stand or sell sexual services for money or do whatever, you know, we don't feel like they've lost something that they're never going to get back, some integral part of themselves.
But let's imagine two camps. But it's not two camps, but a matter of simplicity. Sex workers that claim it is work. I'm offering a service. And some feminists, I think they call the abolitionist, it's not work, it is exploitation. Don't call this work. You are not allowed to call this work.
You know, it's very hard to get transsexual people who do not have, they're not really in the body that they want to be in, to take off their clothes and do it.
You don't have thousands lined up, just, you know,
it's a miracle, isn't it?
I think that whatever they have a hard time with, the exploitation, I understand. But I think we should open a real dialogue. That's what's missing right now, a dialogue. Don't tell me a man is abusing me. Please don't do that to me. Allow me to tell you when I am abused. What is abusive for you may not be for me. What is so precious with everything sexual about me? What is so precious about my cunt? What is so precious about the fact that I'm a virgin or not? You're not interested in what I think? You're not interested in what I want to do?
Yeah, in the way that it's linked up with violence against women generally, with the attitude that if you're a bad girl or a fallen woman, you deserve less protection from the law, you deserve less support, that unless you identify yourself as a victim in your sex work, you're considered, yeah, morally reprehensible, or, you know, all the sexist attitudes we invest in women, in the way we try to control sexuality, control behavior by inflicting this good girl, bad girl dichotomy on all sorts of activities, and particularly sexual activities. Whereas all women are accused of being a slut or a whore if they do anything that steps outside the lines, or if we want to attack them in any way to control them. All of these things are so pronounced in prostitution for women.
Another thing is I feel like I hope that it would be a bump start for other people to create, you know, their own sense of self and self-relevance in this world.
I think feminists should open their door and then quarrel if they want. Is it a woman's movement? Yes or no? Is it a select club? We have reproached men all our life that they had select club where we were not allowed to enter. So how come we're not allowed to enter the feminist movement? If feminist means that I'm fighting for woman first, yes, and for every human being, yes. If feminine means because of our position, we have learned how to fight, yes, I'm a feminist. Absolutely.
You just heard the voices of Sid, Lainey Bassman, Christopher Lee, and Francine Tremblay in regards to some of the ways gender and sexuality play into their experiences with the sex trade and its advocacy. Now we will be listening to an interview with Mira Soleil Ross, transsexual sex worker, activist, video maker, and performance artist.
So my name is Mira Soleil Ross, and I'm a transsexual prostitute, and I'm also a video maker and a performance artist and an activist, and I've been around active probably since around 1990. I've worked for 12 years in the sex trade, mostly as a prostitute and full-time, and I started to work on the streets of Montreal in 1990, first as a boy, then slowly I transitioned, started living as a woman, and started to also work as a prostitute as a woman. Somewhere around 1992, 1993, I can never remember. It's flu. I moved to Toronto, and I've been living here since then, and I've continued working as a prostitute. And I was always a political person. It was kind of a logical thing for me to get politically involved in the prostitutes' rights movement when I started working as a prostitute, because I really started to feel fully the impact of the criminalization of prostitution, the stigmatization of prostitutes and of prostitution, and the way prostitutes were treated in our society and in our cultures. And I've also been very involved in the transsexual, transgender rights movement, and but a lot of the work I've done within that movement and within that social justice movement has been really to try to combine my efforts to try to do something for prostitutes, and try to combine that with my efforts to try to do something for transsexual and transgender people. So a lot of my political work around trans issues has been more specifically, even though it was not limited to, more specifically work for low-income, street active, homeless, transsexual, transgender people, and also transsexual and transvestite prostitutes more specifically. Parallel to all of that, I've been doing videos and zines and all kinds of things, and I've done a lot of cultural activism. And around the year 2000, I had done a lot of more traditional form of activism, like giving tons of workshops around, you know, and doing, you know, doing social services-oriented work and working as an outreach worker and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, I felt that there were more and more trans people who were able to do the kind of work I was doing, so I felt I was not as crucial anymore in social services and in more traditional form of activism. So since the year 2000, I'm trying to really stay away from more ordinary kind of activism and try to do most of my work through performance art and video making.
Wow, it sounds like you're very busy. So there's so many things I want to ask you, but maybe we can start with your activism. And I want to ask you whether or not your work within the prostitute rights or the sex worker rights movement intersects with your work in the movement for the rights of transsexuals and transgendered people. Do they collide, or are they separate movements to you? And where are the differences and the similarities?
They're very separate movements to me in the sense that we have, there's a dominant transgender rights movement and transgender cultural scene all over the English speaking world, and particularly even in North America, that's very, very specific in terms of who is part of that movement and who is part of that scene. And who is part of that scene are usually not prostitutes, transsexual, transvestite, transgender prostitutes. So the transsexual, transvestite, a prostitute scene community movement just overlaps with the broader transgender rights movement. We have a different situation in Canada than in the United States. In Canada, when we look at how things started here in most of the major urban centers like Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal, most of the thriving of the activism that we have now for the broad transgender community and movement really was all started by prostitutes in all these various cities. So all of us were prostitutes. All of us were also Francophone. That's interesting. And all of us also didn't come from, you know, upper class background. And so a lot of us, our main focus and our biggest motivation at the beginning in the mid-90s was to really do work, transsexual, trans activism that was geared towards improving the living conditions, the lives, and the, you know, the human rights of trans people who were more marginalized because they were homeless, because they were on the street, because they were using drugs, because they were prostitutes, etc., etc. Now things, you know, are changing a lot, so I don't think that we are anymore at the forefront or as visible as we used to be in the 90s, because there is such a thing now in Canada, just like in the United States, as a much more dominant discourse, a much more dominant movement that's transgender, that is not really led by prostitutes and that does not really represent the interest and the issues of transsexual and transgender prostitutes. So we are still there and we are still doing work. And in Canada, you know, the transgender movement and scene is, in my opinion, better than in the United States, because the origin of it was sparked by transsexual, transvestite prostitutes, but at the same time, we are no longer the ones who are the most visible voices, the most visible faces. The transgender movement in North America is a very hegemonic movement in terms of its discourse, in terms of the political issues that it represents. I think we have seen a shift happening where a lot of transsexual men, female to male, trans people were complaining in the 90s that the organizations were mainly led by male to female trans people. But what we're seeing happening now is the opposite, where most of the organizations not only are dominated by female to male trans people, transsexual men, trans men, but by ones who are queer identified and by ones who come from the lesbian community and by ones who also to different degrees want to remain part of the lesbian community and want to remain part of the women's movement. So a group of people like this is not representative of the really broad range of trans people who are out there, and it's very unfortunate.
How do you see this as problematic to those in the sex industry who are involved in advocacy and activism and the struggle for sex worker rights?
Yeah, I don't have a problem in and of itself with having a thriving community of queer identified trans people who are mainly going from female to male and who primarily come from the lesbian community. I do not have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is when that community calls itself the trans community. I think it's very important that they identify who they are and where they're coming from and realize that they are not representative of the majority of FTMs, first of all, and of trans men, because tons of them are heterosexual, live with women, do not come from the lesbian community, and they're not representative of trans women either. They are certainly not representative of trans prostitutes, and they're not representative of low-income transsexual women particularly. And I think there's this big, naive political dream, you know, of a unified, diverse trans community, and I do not believe in that. I do not believe that you will ever have transsexual, transgender, transvestite prostitutes hang out in trans spaces. spaces, what are now trans spaces, and that's because these trans spaces are spaces where the majority of the people who hang out there, as I said, are FTMs who come from the lesbian community, who are attracted to women, and da-da-dee-da-da-da. So I think it's important that this community of people realize that who they are and what they represent is very, very specific, is not representative of the broad trans community, and that this dream of a unified and diverse trans community in trans spaces and in political organizations is not going to happen. And it's not just because of their fault, it's just because of the way things are. You can't sometimes bring together such a wide range of people who have such a different interest, political needs, and sometimes also contradictory needs. I mean, one of my biggest complaints about the transgender movement is I believe that part of it is inherently anti-transsexual, and part of it, I think, recycles some old 70s anti-transsexual theory and thoughts. And I think that a lot of transgender people believe that they are working towards a society, a culture, a world where either it is a multigendered culture or it is a society where gender no longer exists, that we have destroyed gender. Well, this is in complete opposition to what many transsexual like me want. I am perfectly comfortable and happy in the binary gender system. I embrace the binary gender system. I think that we need to make space so that people who find themselves in between can live comfortably and do not get beaten up when they leave their house and this and this and that. But, I mean, I transitioned to live as a woman because I did not want to be an in-between because this is not what I like, you know? Yeah. So we have ideologies, philosophies, theories, and therefore also political agendas that are sometimes in totally clashing. And that is also another reason why we do not have, for example, a transsexual, transgender prostitutes hanging out that much within the broader transgender movement.
Just for those listeners who will be just tuning in right now, we are talking to Mira Soleil Ross, transsexual video maker, performer, sex worker, and activist. Mira Soleil, I wanted to ask how common it is to find trans people working within the sex industry. I've read somewhere that a disproportionate number of trans sex workers are preoperative, male to female. Is that right? And if it is, why do you think that is?
Well, the sex trade is divided along gender lines. So you have male, you have females, and you have transsexual or transvestites. So, I mean, the transsexual women who are operated, there's not a market for them. I mean, the guys, if they want a vagina, they'll just go for any woman with a vagina. They don't care that it's a transsexual specifically. There's not men drooling at home, fantasizing and jerking off about, you know, eating a specifically transsexual woman's vagina and fucking a specifically transsexual woman's vagina. When they fantasize about vaginas, they just fantasize and jerk off about vaginas in general. So the transsexual women who are post-operative, who have vaginas, you know, sometimes you'll see one who right after their surgery, they try to put an ad. But I always laugh because the ad just is there for 1 week or 2 weeks, and that's it. Because the guys who want to sleep with a transsexual, they want to sleep with a transsexual because we have a penis. That's why they want to sleep with us. They are men who are straight men, heterosexual men who have fantasies and desire to play with the penis, experiment with the penis, but who are not attracted to men, who are not attracted to male body, male energy. So what happens is that there is a very disproportionate number of transsexual women who work in the sex trade. A lot of transgender activists who are not prostitutes will say that this is because trans people are so marginalized, have faced so much discrimination in all areas of their lives, including employment, that this is why so many work in the sex trade. Well, I do not believe that is true. I believe that just like anybody else, you know, money and the financial self-sufficiency is one factor that makes us want to work in the sex trade, but that is not the only one and perhaps not the main one. I think that as transsexual women who are attracted to men, I think that our bodies, our femininity, ourselves are not very validated in general in society, in mainstream society, in the media, including in the queer community. And what happens to us is when we transition and when we start living as women, when we realize that there is a huge, huge, huge number of straight men out there who do eroticize our bodies, who do find our bodies, our femininity, our feminine bodies, our hips, our thighs, you know, our faces, our hair, our smell attractive, that gives us a big, big, big boost in terms of self-esteem and in terms of our positive feelings about ourselves. And I think that this is probably one huge reason why there is such a high number of transsexual women who work in the sex trade. One of the problems, though, is that while there is such a huge number of, you know, transsexual women who work in the sex trade and such a huge number of men who want to sleep with us, I think we're still at a point, I think it is a turning point, but we're still at a point in our culture and society where tons of men are comfortable experimenting sexually with us, but very few of them are ready to take it a step further and create long-lasting, loving, romantic relationship with us because of the social stigma and because of the confusion that people might have around, you know, who are they? Are they gay? Are they bisexual? What's this? They're attracted to women with dick and ta-ta-ti-ta-ta-ta. But I think we are at a turning point, and I think there's a lot of very courageous men out there, straight men, who are starting to form these kinds of bonds with us and longer-lasting relationships.
I want to ask you now about your performance art. I wondered if you could talk about what kind of art you do, what kind of videos you make, how long you've been doing that, and what kind of things you try and express in your performances.
Mm-hmm. I started doing videos in 1993. I come from a theater background. When I was younger, when I was 16 years old, I got very passionate about theater, and I ended up going to l'Université du Québec à Montréal in an acting program. I thought I was going to be an actor, but then I dropped out of there and became a street prostitute because I just couldn't do mysterious male roles. I could do big goofs and hunchbacks and things like that and Scrooge, old Scrooge man, but I was not able to do very serious male characters. I dropped out of this because I just fell apart while I was in the acting program halfway through. Became a street prostitute, but that's where my first interest in arts was through theater. In 1993, one of the biggest thing I was concerned with was the lack of self-representation by transsexual and transgender people. I was looking at queersome festivals, and I saw that over 90% of the films that were made about lesbians and gays and bisexual people were made by lesbian, gays, and bisexual people, but 100% of the films made about trans people in these festivals that were presented were made by non-trans people. And not only that, but often these films were very damaging and hurtful in terms of how they portrayed the issues, how they portrayed people, how they misrepresented us. So I decided, even though I knew nothing about video making, that I decided I was going to do video. So a lot of my video work in the early 90s had to do with really archiving transsexual stories and also producing images of transsexual bodies, transsexual sexualities, and transsexual issues on transsexual terms. I also kept a prostitute video diary between 1990, I think, and 1992 or 1993, where I recorded myself before and after going to work because, you know, the situation of transsexual prostitutes at the time seemed so tragic. So many people were dying and everything that I thought, oh, that's probably what's going to happen to me, and I want to keep a record of some of my stories about my clients. So a lot of the work was about saying we as transsexual and transgendered and transvestite people, we need to make image of ourselves just like queer people do, just like any other community of people is doing it. So since 1997 up until now and more, my video work is much more experimental video work, and there are much more artsy pieces of video, and I'm still dealing with transsexual themes, but I'm not explaining things necessarily verbally. For me, I feel I can finally speak about transsexual issues in a much more complex, subtle, and nuanced way, in a way that I couldn't do it when, for example, I was doing workshops or giving talks around and things like that. I feel I can say things that are much more also powerful, and I believe I can touch people and move people in a much more powerful way by using images and metaphor and experimental form of narrative and treatment of images with video. Then there's my performance work. I work mainly in monologue form now, So, and my biggest piece of work and biggest achievement was to, I wanted to do a piece of performance art that was, that would address anti-prostitution discourses and campaigns and the way they impact negatively on the working conditions and lives of prostitutes, including my own. And I wanted to do a big chunk of work, not just a little monologue and another half monologue here anymore. I wanted to do a big chunk of work. So I worked almost full time for a year on a show, and it turned out to be 7 monologues, and it's called Yapping Out Loud, Contagious Touch from an Unrepentant Whore. And we showed that at the Turn Up the Heat Festival, and it's kind of a really a sum up of all my reflections that are based on years of working as a prostitute and years of political struggle as a prostitute, and on the other hand also my kind of a performance art and development. It's kind of a sum up of everything I've learned around prostitutes' rights issues, and also a kind of a sum up of where I'm at now in terms of what I can do with performance art.
We are lucky enough to be able to play one of Mira Soleil's monologues from her video performance piece, Yapping Out Loud, Contagious Thoughts from an Unrepentant Whore, which she performed over the telephone for me last week. The piece consists of half a dozen monologues, the characters of which include an anti-prostitution feminist, a residence group advocate, and a serial killer. The monologue we are about to listen to is called Dear John.
Alexandre, Camille, Abel, Sacha, Simon, Raoul, Jean-Pierre, François, Mathieu, Angelo, Juan, Mohamed, Alain, Miguel, Gabriel, Raphaël, Eduardo, Cory, Benoît, Thomas, Saïd, Gilles, Maurice, Albert, Régent, Cédric, Carmine, Sylvain, Philippe, Carlos. And of course I shouldn't forget John. How easy it is to stereotype millions of men when they are all referred to as John. Might as well call them Dick. Sexist hypocrites cheating on their wives, and horny brutes willing to buy women's bodies, and ugly boogeymen in trench coats objectifying women. In my book, a bunch of mostly nice guys whose invisibility is perhaps the political missing link to the obtainment of prostitutes' rights. As prostitutes, we too often focus on the few bad tricks, the abusive ones who sneak through our screening process, and the jerks who set up appointments and never show up, and the clumsy twits who squeeze our tits too hard, and the ones with cheesy dicks, and the foul drunks, and the ones who purposely take longer than what they paid for to come. Those make for vivid stories at dinner parties and at performance art events. And feminism has had squat shit impact on those guys. All feminism ever did is make my sweetest clients feel guilty and make me have to spend some extra time playing political therapist, reassuring them that no, they are not hurting my sense of self, and that if I feel exploited at $150 an hour, I need a serious reality check, and that yes, they should continue seeing me, because otherwise I'll end up left with only stinky assholes to sleep with as clients. I don't know if it is because they stand in such extreme contrast to the way they are portrayed by feminists, but there's something in my clients and their tenderness and gestures towards me that I find deeply moving. It's in their voice when they finally get a hold of me on the phone. It's in their smiles when they open the door and invite me in. It's in the sparkles of light I see in their eyes when I say, first I collect my money and then I tickle your nipples. It's in the way they tense their bodies and hold their breaths when I very gently put my lips on those neglected areolas and start sucking on them. It's in their shivering skin when I slowly work my way up to kiss their tight necks. When I start rubbing my body against theirs, it's in those few seconds when it feels like we're suspended in time and they hold on and hold on and hold on as much as they can before finally allowing themselves to release decades of repressed desires. It's in their nervously shaking, moist hands trying to caress me with the intentions of the best lovers. Then it's in their goosebumps and gluttony and giggling and growling and lowing in glory. It is also in less poetic moments when they say, those are beautiful tits, while caressing my implants, which actually feel about as delicate as a pair of 5-pin bowling balls. For the most part, it isn't their courage to see me, a transsexual woman, again and again, because yes, in this culture it takes courage for men to get so close and so intimate with an individual whom a large percentage of the population considers a freak. My clients constantly remind me that with reclaiming prostitution as a fundamental and legitimate service come responsibilities. I recently visited for the first time Claudio, a very attractive, fit 38-year-old Italian man who had a lovely penis, the kind I like, with enough foreskin to wrap all of next year's holiday season presents. Things were going quite well, we were both enjoying each other, but he somehow seemed uncomfortable with his body. At one point, he even interrupted our session to take a little break. He wanted to hold me in his arms and caress my hair, but while doing so, I noticed him examining his penis and looking quite perplexed. Just as I thought, oh no, not another one who wants to know if I find it big enough, he asked in the saddest voice, am I circumcised? Because I have no idea. Whether I am working with a 600-pound disabled man who can't reach his penis to masturbate, or an intersex guy whose genitals are nothing like the ones you're used to dealing with, or simply the average Joe Blow who wants to start under the blankets because he's too shy, the men I meet force me to be sensitive to a certain reality. That I am not dealing with objects here, but with complex and vulnerable individuals who can be stricken by as many body image problems, self-concept issues, and fears of sexual inadequacy as anyone else. Some of my clients are married men, but it becomes clear when speaking with most of them that they love their wives, they very much enjoy their companionship, and want to spend the rest of their lives with them. It's just that sexuality has become limiting and lifeless, or is simply absent from the relationship. And every so often I meet one man whose dedication to his wife I find particularly commendable. Anthony is one of them. He started seeing me years after his wife fell ill due to multiple sclerosis. Every time we'd get together, he would update me on her deteriorating condition and on his struggle trying to keep his family above water, working two jobs in order to afford a private nurse so that his wife wouldn't be locked up in a hospital room for the rest of her life. Last time I saw him, he said she was completely incapacitated and no longer cognizant. He told me with tears in his eyes that the idea of dating any woman before his wife passed away was emotionally unbearable, and that, I thought, brought true meaning to the word commitment. Ali is another man I've been seeing for years. He works for minimum wage at the Kochek of a restaurant. He's been fighting for almost a decade with the immigration system, spending thousands of dollars in legal fees, trying to have his wife, about whom he speaks with so much love, join him here. When I found out how much he was earning an hour and about his costly ordeal with immigration, I felt concerned, so I told him that maybe he should reconsider spending money to see me. Don't worry, he insisted, and rightfully offended, adding that it was all budgeted and that all of his meager tips were put aside just to see me. If I didn't get a few minutes of joy every couple of months, he concluded abruptly, I'd probably kill myself. Michael is a man I saw only once. He called me up for an appointment and mentioned that he was sexually inexperienced, that he had been with very few women in his life, never with a transsexual, and that he felt very intimidated. It was a busy day. I was a high on Jolt Cola, juggling prostitution with a million chores related to my political and artistic life. So I said in a sales pitch tone, I'll be right there to take good care of you. He was a tall, handsome 60-year-old who spoke and moved with the grace and grounded serenity of James Earl Jones. Our rendezvous unfolded perfectly, so before we parted, he said, thank you, which they always do, so you're welcome, I replied very mechanically. But he took my hand, held it over his heart. He gave me this so sweet bisou on the left cheek and said, I mean, thank you. Now, I could tell there was more to this thank you than simple gratitude for activating his vas deferens, so I asked why. He told me about how he'd been with his wife for 40 years, that she had died 2 years earlier, and that he had never been with anyone other than her in all these years. He thought he'd never again feel at ease being intimate with someone until he heard my French accent on an escort service line. These are times when I feel like revolting against this system that's ready to condemn and even jail us for caressing, kissing, and holding each other. These are times when I rid myself of all the fears and anxieties I have about the long-term ramifications of being a prostitute, a social pariah. These are times when I feel it is worth growing into an old, tired, bitter, dried-up whore. These are times when I feel like there was, indeed, a higher calling for me to sacrifice my personal reputation, comfort, safety, social status, and even my freedom for a greater good.
If you are just tuning in, this is Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy, a special four-week series every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are continuing our conversation with Miro Soleil Ross, a transsexual street sex worker, activist, video maker, and performance artist, about gender and sexuality as they relate to the sex trade. I sort of am interested in how the experience of sex work differs along gender lines and depending on people's gendered understanding of their own sexualities. You said that you worked as a street sex worker both as a boy and then again and during your transition. I was wondering if you might be able to talk about how the experience changed or didn't change.
Mm-hmm. When I worked as a boy, first of all, I was a feminine boy with a small penis. I was not masculine, and I was not very, even though I find I was a cute boy, gay men didn't agree with me. So I was not very marketable. First of all, I had a terrible time when I tried to live as a gay boy. I was not able to find really long-term boyfriends. I had difficulty, you know, my sex life was pretty limited because there were not that many gay men who were sexually interested in me. And then imagine I started to work as a prostitute. So it was terrible. But I was getting older gay men who came from a very, very different generation, guys over 50, who came from a time maybe when this hyper masculinity was not maybe as much dominant in the gay community in terms of gay men's fantasies. So I was getting a lot of maybe a number of older gay men as clients, and I was getting also some bisexual men as clients. So I mean, I was not making a lot of money. I was making just barely enough to survive when I was working as a boy, and that was for about a year. I worked for 2 years as a boy, but 1 year of that was both as a boy during the day and as a woman at night. But in addition to that, in general, boys don't make as much money as either transsexual or women in the sex trade. And I think that is partly due to the fact that there is a huge scene for men to have sex with other men for free. There's tons of bad houses, you know, tons of places where men can have sex for free with other men. There's not tons of places where straight men can find women to have sex for free all over the place. So when I started living as a woman, the first thing that happened is, first of all, I was getting real money. From making $30, $40 a client, I was suddenly making $100 a client. So that was a big shift. And then I was getting men who were really, really attracted to me and were really, really enjoying my femininity and were really enjoying my... At that time, it was much more of an androgynous body because I was not even on hormones yet, but they were appreciating what was feminine in me. So that was a big change. I would say now, when I think about, when I reflect back on all these years that I've been working, I think one of the biggest difference that I see between me and my genetic female colleagues who work as prostitutes is they can fake it. You know, I have friends who can see lots of clients. They can pretend to come. You know, they put lubricant in their vagina so it looks like they're excited and this and this and that. I find much more exhausting investments sexually with my clients, and therefore it becomes much more part of my sexuality because I need to have erections with them. And when you're on hormones and everything, you do not get this kind of very spontaneous erection and sexual reaction that I find genetic men get. You know, genetic men can get erection even when they're not excited. But when you're on hormones, you don't function as spontaneously like that. So it takes a lot of efforts and a lot of energy and a lot of psychological juggling and acrobacies in order to be able to have erection and look like I'm sexually excited with my clients. I cannot fake it. And that, to me, is one of the biggest difference I see between me and my genetic female colleagues.
The sex industry seems to be an issue that's taken on by a lot of feminists because in the popular mind, it's viewed as sort of a domain of women's issues, and it gets held up as a, you know, epitomizing the patriarchal agenda to control women's bodies and women's sexuality. I'm wondering how you would respond to this popular sort of gender analysis of sex work.
We could talk about that for an hour, but I think one of my basic analysis of prostitution is I believe that this is one of the few places in our culture and society where women have power, where women have this thing, which is sex, which is a pussy, which is tits, or in my case, a dick that men want. I do believe that at the onset, we have power over men in a prostitute client relationship. That, of course, can be different depending on the context in which you're working. You know, it can be nuanced because it depends on the working conditions. I mean, you might have some work constraints that a worker like me, who's working on my own independently as an escort, have. But I still believe that basically, when we are prostitutes, wherever we are working, that we do have power over men, financial and sexual power. So that is completely different from the analysis of anti-prostitution feminists, to believe that this is the opposite, that the prostitute male client relationship is the perfect example of the subjugation and objectification of women in our culture. So they see the opposite. They see that it is the man who has the power. From my experience working for 12 years and working with thousands of clients, it's completely the opposite. I feel that I'm the one who has the power. I mean, then we can get into all the intricacies of the theory and all the areas where I feel it is wrong, and where I feel that my day-to-day experience and years of working in the sex trade with male clients, where it contradicts the theories of these feminists. But basically, I feel that everything they're saying is completely wrong. They got it all wrong, and I believe that this is because their theories are elaborated from some theories, whereas my analysis of prostitution is elaborated from my day-to-day experience working with thousands of guys and speaking with other prostitutes and living and working with hundreds and hundreds of other prostitutes. So it's informed by day-to-day real life experience as opposed to from books. I think that these anti-prostitution feminist theories about prostitution are elaborated from books, and from books written by people who often have never met a prostitute.
Just to change gears a little bit, I wanted to ask you about gender as it relates to the medicalization of our bodies and how sexual identity is sort of filtered through the medical system.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, earlier I was talking about this transgender movement and how my analysis and the analysis of a lot of other transsexual people differs from a lot of the ideas, theories, and agendas put forward by the transgender movement. One of the big debates we've been having since the mid-90s is this new transgender movement, whom I believe is made of much more privileged, financially well-off, educated people than in previous decades. That transgender movement has taken issue with the so-called medicalization, and some will say colonization, of trans bodies. And I have an issue with that because I do believe that my body is medicalized. I'm taking hormones. I require medical technologies. I am going to the doctors to have assistance with all kinds of medical procedures. And I don't have any problem with my transsexual issues being medicalized. What I have a problem with is when there's abuse of powers, when there isn't consultation with transsexual people in relation to how services for transsexual people, medical services and medical technology, should be made available to transsexual people. But I do believe basically that yes, it is a medical issue. One of the biggest debates we've been having is as to whether or not transsexuality should be seen as a medical disorder, because transsexuality for many, many years has been in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. So the transgender movement has lobbied very hard to try to remove anything that relates to gender identity or transsexuality from that book, because they say that the doctors have colonized us, have medicalized us, and being in that book is producing a situation in which trans people are being institutionalized psychiatric institutions. I do not believe any of that bullshit. I do not believe that there was any real proof made of that. And I turn it around and I say to them that the reason that doctors like Harry Benjamin and many others started to so-called medicalize transsexual bodies and transsexual issues is because transsexual people themselves were showing up in doctors' offices in the 60s and the 70s asking them to have transsexuality be recognized as a medical issue, and in some cases be recognized as a disability, and in some cases be recognized as a mental illness. So we are the ones who have asked for that, and I think that we again have to acknowledge that it is not the doctors and the psychiatrists who have decided to medicalize and psychiatrize us. We are the ones who have asked for that, because in previous decades, the people who were asking for that were not upper class, financially comfortable, educated, predominantly, you know, Anglophone people who were uncomfortable with the stigma of disability and the stigma of mental illness, and the stigma of having a medical disorder attached to them. And now we're seeing a movement to demedicalize and remove transsexuality and gender identity from the DSM. I believe because the people who are wanting that are privileged people who do not want to be associated with disabled people, who do not want to be associated with psychiatric survivors, and who do not want to be associated with people who have illnesses and disease. And personally, I think that this is a very problematic position.
One of the reasons, too, that I asked about medicalization is because the healthcare system in Canada has sort of come up a few times in my conversations with sex workers, especially in regards to some of the adverse effects of criminalization and marginalization. All of the different ways sex workers don't have access to the same things that other people have access to. Uh-huh. And it would seem to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that access to adequate healthcare is especially important to trans people, given that they are often so medicalized, especially during transitions.
Yes, exactly. I think we do need, well, you see, that's the point, is I do not want to have trans people who are not interested in transforming their bodies through medical technologies, i.e. taking hormones, getting genital surgeries or other surgeries like chest surgeries, breast surgeries. I am not interested in having trans people who have no interest in getting their own bodies transformed through medical technologies come and tell me that we shouldn't be medicalized and we shouldn't be in the DSM and that transsexuality shouldn't be seen as a, that's none of their business, you know. People like me want to have access to medical technologies, and if we want to have them paid by the state or by insurance companies, we cannot turn around and say that it's not a medical issue. You know, a few years ago here, we had the government of Ontario stop funding sex change surgeries, and I turned towards people and I say, well, don't complain when for years you've been saying it's not a medical issue. And if it's not a medical issue, the government and the population is going to say, well, then it's a cosmetic issue and it's a lifestyle choice, and then we shouldn't have taxpayers paying for that.
And I wanted to ask you how you would like to see the sex industry change for the better, and how you'd like to see its status in society change, and the status of sex workers as well as transsexual people and transgendered people.
Yeah, I think in society at large, I would just like to see society recognize sex work as a service. I mean, people need to eat, people need to clothe themselves, people need to, you know, have a place to live, a home. Well, I think most people nowadays believe that sex is a very healthy biological needs, and it's a need that needs to be fulfilled in order to live really healthy lives as human beings and as members of society. So if it is, and if we all recognize that it is a basic human need, sex is a basic human need, it makes no sense to turn around and say there shouldn't be people and professionals that are there to respond to that need, because we have professional people who respond to every other needs that human beings have in relation to eating, in relation to having a place to live. So that's what I'd like society to do. I'd like society to accept that it's a basic human need that contributes to a person's overall well-being, psychological, sexual, physical, and then accept that there needs to be people who will respond to that need and legitimize and validate the work that as prostitutes we are accomplishing in this world. As transsexual, transgender prostitutes, I think we are accomplishing something even further. I think that we, all throughout the world, in every major urban center throughout the world, we have a total of hundreds of thousands of transsexual, perhaps millions of transsexual, transgender, transvestite prostitutes working. That means that we are sleeping with millions of men worldwide on a daily basis. And I believe that this is a completely unacknowledged political contribution to transforming society and transforming this culture, so that this culture, this society, recognize that transsexual people, we are people like anybody else, that we shouldn't be treated badly, that we should have human rights protection, etc., etc. I think that all the men that we are sleeping with, we are changing them, we are making them more open-minded and tolerant and accepting and embracing of transsexual people. But in addition to that, I think even though they are not gay, all these men who sleep with, all these millions of men who sleep with transsexual, transvestite, trans prostitutes, even though they're not gay and they're straight, I think that sleeping with us make them more also tolerant and embracing of queer people and of lesbians, gays, and bisexual people. So I think that as transsexual, transvestite prostitutes, we are doing an immense political contribution to changing society and changing culture in order that this culture and this society be a more inclusive and embracing one of trans people and of queer people in general. And I think that's something that I would like the queer community and the broad trans community to recognize as this political contribution of ours. In relation to what I'd like to see happening within the sex worker or within the prostitutes community, I am tired of whining prostitutes. I am tired of people who work in the sex trade who perfectly know that there's all kinds of violation of human rights that we face on a daily basis, but who are doing squat shit to change things. I mean, it's a handful of prostitutes and of sex workers who are politically active, and I do understand that there's enormous risk that comes with being public and visible as prostitutes and as sex workers, but I am tired of the prostitutes and of the sex workers who are doing squat shit to try to change things. And I think that there's a lack of honesty amongst a lot of sex workers and a lot of prostitutes, and I am tired of it. And I think the ones of us who are politically active, we have to start denouncing it, and we have to start challenging these other sex workers and prostitutes who are regurgitating the language of social workers, the language of feminists that is fed to them, who are not honest, and who are therefore contributing to creating a social and cultural context in which, as prostitutes and as sex workers, we face daily violations of our basic human rights.
It's 2 in the morning, my beeper's going off. I'm naked, I roll over, enough is enough. These bitches always call me morning, noon, and night. Gladys and Rhonda, Darlene, she's tight, right? What can I say? They can't stay away from the best cock on the block today. What can I say? They can't stay away from the best cock on the block today. It's eternally.
It's eternally.
Come over and try them. I am like no other. You like them real big? I got a GMC Ram. You like them little? I got a mini pickle. I aim to satisfy. I aim to please. Just give me some booty that I can squeeze.
You have been listening to Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy. Episode 3 of a 4-week series. Thank you to Mira Soleil Ross, as well as Sid, Laney Bassman, Christopher Lee, and Francine Tremblay, whose voices we heard at the beginning of the program. Thanks also to Gretchen King, Michael O'Keefe, and Judith Toib here at CKUT. Stay tuned next week as we wrap up this 4-week series with an episode on sex work activism and organizing, locally and internationally, and as it relates to other social struggles. If you would like a copy of this week's episode or the series as a whole, call CKUT's news department here in Montreal at 514-398-6787, extension 2593. My name is Brett Story for CKUT 90.3 FM, long-term memory radio. Thanks for listening.
Ew, you're one of them girly men. Well, I need more man in my men. We could meet next week. We could be great friends. We could meet next week. We could meet next week. Nah, see, I'm a lady lover. I'm a lady leaver. Just one taste and you'll be a believer. So girl, take that. My dick's so big, I don't even have to pack it.
Eternally.
It's eternally.
trying to make my way in a man's world. Yeah, I'm just a little girl boy, trying to make my way in a man's world. So, I gotta go, got my 40 and my lucky charm dildo.